This episode is brought to you by North Texas Honda Dealers. North Texas Honda Dealers, they're here to help.
He has time, launches it to the end zone. Touchdown! Terrence Williams!
The throw goes to the right side for Crabtree. It's caught. He played. Oh, he's the worst ever!
Puts it up the right sideline.
Yeah, he's got to go. He's tackled. Sam Houston wins it. The Bearcats capture their first FCS championship.
Hello, and welcome to the Republic of Football. I'm your host, Ishmael Johnson. We are a show that is trying to watch the World Cup early on Sunday. Here with me, as usual, is Mike Craven. Mike, man, how are you doing?
Doing pretty good. There was only one night game last night, so, you know, I was in bed by 10:30. It was a beautiful thing.
And as always with us as well is Mallory Hartley. Mallory, how are you?
Good. The state went 8-3 this week, so I'd say it's a pretty successful week for the state of Texas in the college football world.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Don't look at how some of those wins came. Just look at the wins.
Yeah, exactly.
And two of those losses were to other in-state teams. So,
right. You know, so it was really a pretty good week for us. Yeah.
Yep.
Pretty good week. If I sound different, it's because I was very smart and I forgot my mic at the office. So, you know, if I sound a little different, that's apologies on my fault. On my part. But let's get into it. We're just going to go with the game that Mike Craven was at and the one that everybody's talking about. TCU 29, Baylor 28, now tying Texas and A&M as the most played rivalry in the state. I mean, we can start at the obvious point, which is the wild scramble drill at the end for TCU to get the field goal off. I mean, for TCU and Sonny Dykes to pull that off, I texted you, Mike. I said, I think I love Sonny Dykes because the nonchalantness that they handled that entire final drive. And then for them to just – the fact that they called like an inside zone on 3rd and 7 with 17 seconds to go and then just seamlessly ran the field goal unit on there. By the way, I went back and watched it. Kel did not even square the ball, like the kick. You know, kickers like walk up and do their little walk back. He just ran to where he was going to stand and kicked it like flawlessly executed. TCU wins. I mean, it seemed like everybody in McLean was there like an hour after just because they were like, wait, was that it? Like,
they were ready to storm the field.
they were like, I mean, we'll talk about it. Craven, you know, what did you see when you were there? But yeah, it just felt like everybody there was like, wait, is it over?
Yeah, I mean, I lost about 450 words of print, you know, because yeah. I had most of it written up. You know, they're down 8. They missed that 2-point conversion that was dropped basically there that was going to tie it. So, you know, these games are always crazy. We talked about it in the pregame show. You know, the average margin of victory over the last four has been 6.25. It doesn't matter who's the good team, who's the bad team on paper. Last year, TCU pulled the upset on Baylor, who won the Big 12 championship in the Sugar Bowl. So, you know, that's what rivalry games are. That's what makes college football so crazy. And have y'all ever seen that gif where like Diddy's looking at somebody on like, I don't know, Dancing with the Stars or some game show, and they're like staring at each other for like 5 seconds? When we asked Sonny Dykes after the game about like, was that the plan? And he was like, yeah, we practice that every Thursday. That's what we like to do. And those last second field goals, I stared at Sonny Dykes in that exact same way, you know, of like, I don't know if that's true, but they call it their bazooka field goal unit. Dave Aranda even said in the press conference afterwards that that's something every team practices, Baylor practices as well. It seemed like they were more worried about where they got the ball on the field. They wanted it towards the right hash mark so he could pull it a little bit. So I guess he's got a natural draw, you know, Griffin Cale does. And so they were more worried about the position of the ball than the time. They thought they had enough time. It was a weird set though, right? Because they run the ball on first down, they spike it on second down, and then they run it again on third down. You would think first down, you get the ball to where you want it to go. You wait until the clock gets to 3, then you spike it, then you take your time to run up on the field goal thing. But, you know, especially because Kel had missed an extra point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that's the thing is like, he's the hero now, but we were all going to talk about how TCU lost their college football playoff possibility on an extra point miss. That's what this game was going to come down to for him to be able to go out there and redeem himself and get that kick in that way was awesome. You know, I made a joke on Twitter that I guess Horned Frogs have nine lives, because this TCU team, every single week, they're 5-0 when they're trailing in the second half. They're the antithesis of Texas, right? Like, they play four quarters of football. They tend to play their second half better than the first half. And what's really impressive about this is that last quarter, they didn't have Quentin Johnston on the field. They didn't have Darius Davis on the field. And they didn't have Kendre Miller on the field. And they still went 60 yards and 90 seconds or whatever to get into field goal, you know, position and tie that game. So hats off to Max Duggan, who's clearly not 100%. This TCU team's off week was week three, you know, so they've been playing a lot of football. They are beat up. They were dealing with the flu. They've had a lot of stuff going on, like everybody in college football does. But it's a battle of attrition. And so far, TCU's kind of stood the test of time.
Yeah, one of the things that I noticed definitely in this game was TCU did not play, in my opinion, well for 80% of this game, right? Like, they didn't run the ball really well. Tay Barber was kind of all they had, except that one drive from Gunnar Henderson, where he was kind of the go-to guy. And they were, I don't know, it looked like they were waiting for that. I mean, obviously with Quentin Johnson out, you know, they didn't have that big play, but it was just like, you could tell they were like prodding Baylor to like try and set something up or try and get it going, and it just never happened. And then you look up and they are still in it. And we can talk about why that is in a bit with Baylor, but yeah, this team just feels like, I mean, you know, the big question was November Sunny, right? When the month started, was like, is this a guy who gets kind of found out as the season goes along? And even if he's quote unquote more found out than he was earlier in the season, like, they're still winning, man. And they're just getting it done. And I saw some people saying, you know, literally up until the kick, like, well, this team's out, you know, we're done. We're going to get Tennessee back in the playoff or whatever. And, you know, this, it was fun for TCU, and they're still here. And it's wild how, and I think that's honestly at this point in the season, I think that's what is kind of keeping this team going, is knowing that they're still there, right? Like, it's not, I wonder, and I hate to, you know, psychoanalyze players like this, but I wonder if maybe if they had one loss, right? If they say lost the Oklahoma State game or something, that if they really do pull this out, because you're in the Big 12 title game already, you're kind of, you know, you kind of do, I wonder if there's that extra gear knowing that no. We can make the college football playoff now, right? And I wonder if that's just enough to give them a little bit of adrenaline boost late in games, especially this game.
I mean, I think it has to be, right? I mean, you're down two with 90 seconds to go, and you're not just playing to win a rivalry game on the road or to win a conference championship. I mean, you're literally playing to be the first team in the state of Texas to ever make a college football playoff. To be a TCU team that does that after going 5-7 and losing its 20-year tenured head coach the year before would be insane. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you look up and you're TCU and you got a home game against Iowa State, an Iowa State team that doesn't have a lot to play for, that just lost last night. And then you get basically a home game in Arlington against either Kansas State or Texas, a team that you've already beat. And I, you know, to your point, Ish, I think one of the things that's keeping them going is that every single week people talk about how they don't belong to be there.
True.
You know, this isn't a team that's like hanging on to a college football spot and has like all this to play for and all these expectations, kind of like what looked to happen to Tennessee yesterday or something. This is a team that nobody believes should be there. You know, you look on social media, you look on this, you know, the pregame shows, you look at all that, all the noise around, and nobody thinks that they should be there. And you asked Sonny about it yesterday, and he's like, well, I don't think they believe what they're saying 50% of the time, and we don't care. And I think the coaching staff probably doesn't, but I think it's human nature if you're a player to be like, man, we're undefeated and we're only a 2.5-point favorite against a 4-loss Baylor team. Yeah. You know, like, you know, and so
underdog last week against Texas.
Yeah. Underdog 7 points against a Texas team that can't get out of its own way. And so I think that has to be added motivation that, like, hey, we're playing really well, and nobody believes in us. And on the flip side, you know, I was just looking at it for Baylor. You know, Baylor, that was a Baylor football game yesterday, right? I mean, they ran the ball 46 times, 232 yards. They scored 3 touchdowns. Jeff Grimes was in his bag. Like, some of those plays, the wide zone, the counter stuff was awesome. But you look at Baylor and, you know, they're now 2-3 in one possession games. Mm-hmm. Last year, they were 4-1. And that, you know, that's the difference between having a really good season and being in Big 12 contention. And having a disappointing season and being left out of it. And so it's fine margins. But right now, TCU's winning those coin flip games that are coming down to a play or two, and Baylor hasn't. as well as they did last year. And it might be the difference between one team winning the Big 12 in 2021 and the other team winning the Big 12 in 2022.
Yep. Last thing on TCU before we get to Baylor. I saw some people speculating that Baylor and Dave Aranda kind of messed up the last play because they were like, oh, they should have slow subbed, right? As TCU brought on the unit, they probably should have said, they probably should have drifted one guy out there while the ref's holding the ball, whatever, and drained the clock. Somebody did bring up the rule book afterwards. The refs handled that perfectly. I'm reading from it right here. Team B should reasonably expect that Team A will attempt a field goal in this situation being fourth down, and should have its field goal defense unit ready. The umpire will not stand over the ball, as there should be no issue of the defense being uncertain about the next play. So, you know, obviously when the offense makes a sub, that's an adjustment the defense can't account for normally, so the ref gives them a chance to sub. On fourth down, that goes away. You should expect them to kick a field goal, basically, in this situation. So for people speculating like, oh, the refs messed that up or Baylor messed that up, they played it perfectly.
And Aranda addressed that after the game. I mean, somebody asked him that, and he was like, yeah, we're not allowed to do that. So,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, it's one of those weird rules that, like, there is a rule for every scenario, and people just like, oh, there it is right there, like in between the lines. Anyway, I do want to talk about Baylor a little bit. You mentioned Jeff Grimes, and I thought, yes, absolutely in his bag. I thought he schemed a hell of a run game. I thought he schemed the pass game really, really well. I have a question for you. Is Blake Shapen a better quarterback than he was at the start of the season?
No, but I don't know if that's on coaching or even on Shapen. I don't know who he's supposed to throw the ball to. You know, like when you have the, you know, eagle eye view of the press box, you get an all 22 view. And Baylor doesn't have guys that get open. They don't have Quentin Johnston. They don't have Darius Davis. They don't have Tate Barber. You know, their best wide receiver is Monterey Baldwin, who's a good player, but he's better after the catch than he is before it. You know, they don't have somebody who demands double teams on the outside like a Quentin Johnston. They don't have a guy who's an excellent route runner like a Darius Davis. They just don't have that. And I think Blake Shapen's just a dude. You know, he's not a superstar. But he has great arm talent. He made three or four throws yesterday that nobody else on the field was making, not even Max Duggan.
Sure.
And so, you know, the talent's there. The consistency is not. The decision-making sometimes is not. But I also think they're hindered by their weapons on the outside. And I think their best outside receiver is Josh Cameron, who's a walk-on from Cedar Park. You know what I mean? They're going to, you know, if there's a, you know, I'm sure after the season, we'll kind of do a piece or a podcast on, you know, where does each school need to hit the transfer portal the hardest? And if you're Baylor, it's got to be wide receivers, because you cannot go into 2022 with that same group of wide receivers if you're going to be successful. Sure, you want to run the football more than you throw it, but you have to be explosive. And they had that last year. They had guys like that last year with Tyquan Thornton, but they don't. You know, there's no RJ Sneed here. There's no Thornton here. They just don't have those guys. They're going to have to go find those dudes, especially on the outside. And I think that will help Shapen, but he's never going to be a guy who's 35 of 44 for 350 yards and four touchdowns. That's not what they ask him to do, and it's not who he is. I think he's a fine quarterback. I think he's a winning quarterback, but I think he's a guy who needs everything around him to be going really well. And right now on the outside, it's just not. I mean, they have tight ends and they got slot receivers, and that's about it.
I think he saw a lot of both the good and the bad, right? In the first half, mostly good, except for that second half interception. That was kind of the bad. And then obviously the last, his last throw, or last play of the game, I should say, where he's rolling out, wide receivers kind of in the middle of coverage, and he could have, if he really needed to, he probably could have rifled a ball in there, decides to take the risk-averse play, which kind of summarizes his game overall, like the risk-averse play. And keeps in is short of the first down. So you kind of saw both. And I think overall, not to put the game on him, but I think overall the limits of this offense, not just necessarily Blake Shapen, but the limits of this offense and the playmakers on this offense is kind of what kept Baylor or TCU in the game rather. All right. Moving on to one of our other games of the week. Tulane 59, SMU 24. Listen, this is what happens when you don't have an offense that can score 77 every time. This was an old school Willie Fritz style game where they just ran the damn ball down their throat, and SMU's defense isn't very good. We knew that, and in a way I'm kind of like shrugging, because I don't know. To me, SMU season's done. Like they got the bowl. They got the, you know, we kind of know what they are. They're a bad defense or a good offense. And man, I don't know. I didn't expect this, but yeah, I don't know, man. Tulane still has a lot to play for at SMU. I don't say they don't have anything to play for, but their goal is tapped out to me for right now.
I mean, they give up a lot of points. You know, the only teams that they've held under 27 points this year are North Texas and Lamar. You know, that was back in week one and week two. So, you know, they give up a lot of points. They're expected to score a lot of points. And it's one of those things where you can't turn the ball over five times when you have a bad defense. Sure, you know, like that's just not going to work. You know, like what we're talking about with Blake Shapen, you know, there's sometimes where you have to be risk adverse. Like you have to know what's on the other side of the field. And that if you give away two free possessions, you're going to lose that game, much less five. And so, you know, Tulane scored what, 57 or 59 points. They ran 56 plays.
Yeah. It was nuts.
You know, like they only had to throw
59-24 was not, it was 49-7 at one point. It was not even that close. Like,
right. And you know, if Tulane wanted to be mean, they probably could have scored 70 plus. They probably could have put the 77 back on SMU. You know, that's how bad that defense was. That was the worst performance of the year. It did look like a team in SMU that achieved its goal the week before and maybe had a little bit of a mental breakdown there on a short week going in, you know, a road game on Thursday in New Orleans. That can be that can be a little tricky in and of itself as well. And so it just feels like one of those games where there was a little bit of a let off of gas, and then Tulane's on the other side. They're playing for an American Conference championship. Like they still have everything out in front of them, especially after the UCF loss. And so it just looked like one team that was really motivated and one team that wasn't. And the team that was really motivated played a clean, excellent game of football, and SMU did not. And so it's back to the drawing board. But like you said, I think they've accomplished what they want to accomplish this year. It's about figuring out who those guys are going into the offseason. And you know, like we talked about with Baylor and the wide receivers, it's very clear where SMU needs to improve before the start of the 2023 season. And that is everywhere that you can possibly imagine on defense. I would think that there's only two or three spots that are locked up going into 2023. The rest are open for business. And so, you know, that's a good or a bad thing, depending on how you look at it. But yeah, a humbling loss for SMU for sure. They had been playing their best football of the year going into that game. Mm-hmm. And then they got beat down like that. And so we'll see what they're made of going into next week.
313 on the ground, 7.6 yards per carry for Tulane. So like I said, old style Willie Fritz, going back to Georgia Southern days, basically there. All right, moving on to Texas Tech 14, Iowa State 10. Your Red Raiders are bowling. And man, it wasn't ugly, but they pulled it out. That, you know, Tyler Shuck tweeted after the game, shout out to the defense, because a defense that has been maligned quite a bit this season, better than in years past, but definitely still struggling. And they're the ones that pulled this out, man. They get in a slugfest with an Iowa State team that definitely knows what a slugfest is. And when your offense isn't cooking and, you know, Tyler Shuck's not clicking and it's just not getting things done, you know, you're going to have to be in a brawl. And the defense pulled this one out. And, you know, they get a late score from, I think, Baylor Cup, was it? And, you know, come out with a win. And you're going bowling, man. Joey McGuire in his first season. That's a huge, huge win, a huge moment for them.
Tyler Shuck, 3-0 as a starter this year. You know, leading them to six wins. They're bowl eligible. And I think the biggest narrative coming out of this game is that they're 4-4 in Big 12 play. And they host Oklahoma next week. And if they win that game, this will be the first time Texas Tech's been above 500 or even 500. 500 or above. Since 2009, when Mike Leach was there, you know, that's three coaches ago. To do that in year one and with a pretty tough schedule, a very hard out of conference schedule with Houston and North Carolina State, impressive. And they got a road win. We talked about it on the Wednesday show. As a first year head coach, you're just trying to check off accomplishments. They were 0-4 on the road going into that game. That was their last road game. You don't want to go winless that first year, because then you got to answer questions about, like, what's your routine like on the road? Do you need to mix some things up? Why are you having so many problems on the road? Well, now you can go, well, you know, the four teams we lost to on the road were ranked when we played them. You know, when we played a team that was similar to our competition, we won. We went on the road and beat Iowa State. So I think that's good for the psyche of the program. This is not a game Texas Tech wins previously. Right? Like, they need to outscore people to win games most of the time. Tim DeRuiter's come in there and made the defense probably the strength of the team, at least over the last 6 weeks in Big 12 play. Yep. The defense has been way more consistent than the offense. Not an impressive stat line for Tyler Shuck, not an impressive stat line for the running game, but zero turnovers. He did not throw an interception. And when you're going to play those kind of tight low scoring defensive games, if you can limit turnovers, punt the ball, and, you know, rely on your defense, you can win football games on the road in the Big 12. Iowa State's basically Iowa. You know, yeah, like that, that's who mm-hmm. they are. They're not going to score many points. I think Texas Tech knew going in there, if we could get to 17, we're going to win this game. If we get to 21, we may win by 10. And so they were playing that way. They were pretty conservative. And I was impressed that Zach Kittley could do that. You know, like I think sometimes you kind of can get a little bit ahead of your skis, you know, and be like, ah, you know, I've been reined in. And you go and you got to call the shot play. And sometimes you can get yourself in trouble. He showed a lot of discipline yesterday. And that's how Texas Tech had to win that game. It was a good win for Texas Tech. And now you can go into the last game of the season against an Oklahoma team not needing to win that football game. If you win, that's great. If you win, that's awesome. But if you lose, it doesn't erase any positives from the season. They've gotten to 6 wins. They're going to go bowling. The recruiting's going well. And so right now, everything's, you know, rolling smoothly for our guy, Joey McGuire.
Yep. That's one more thing I wanted to mention. So we talked about it a little bit in the previous show, and if you can go 7 wins in the regular season the year after you fire Matt Wells, right, a marked improvement from the year before, that should, I mean, we knew that this was a long-term play, and we knew that this was probably the right move moving on from Matt Wells, but if you can have that tangible improvement in year one, right, that's just says enough right there. So, there's still a lot to play for, especially if you're Joey McGuire, kind of validating your hire.
Because if you can beat Texas and Oklahoma at home in your first year as a head coach in front of the fan base or whatever, you know, they're going to love you. And that matters a lot.
Two teams that are going to the SEC.
Exactly. Yep. 100%. Exactly. That's a recruiting tool, right?
Yep. There.
Yeah. Okay. Mike Craven, we're going to open up the wide zone. And you said you watched this game because I certainly did not.
Congrats, Craven.
Texas A&M.
On the wide zone.
Texas A&M 20, UMass 3. According to Twitter, every A&M fan I knew watching this game was miserable.
There was no one there by halftime.
There was no one there.
There was nobody there at kickoff. They announced 90,000 people.
I saw that. It was like maybe 900 people there.
Take away.
Thank God for season ticket sales. It was cold. It was miserable. It's an opponent you don't want to see. You're not going bowling. Craven, I don't know. 20-3, I don't know. What you see?
Yeah, I mean, if anybody didn't see, A&M was missing like 25 players. It looked like that flu game a couple weeks ago when like Travis Brown was like tweeting out. It took 2 different tweets to like list how many people, you know, were out. They've lost so many starters, especially on the offensive line, defensive line, to injuries or illness or suspension this year that they just, I don't even know if they've started the same group on either side of the ball once this year. Like it's just been a rotation on both lines of scrimmage. At one point, the students were doing a relay race around Kyle Field.
I did see that. And
you know, like that's how empty the stadium was. You know, they were like running from section to section, handing off, I would assume, a 12th man towel and we're having some kind of race up there. You know, this is what you get when you have an 11 o'clock kickoff when it's cold outside and you're playing a team that's 1-9, you know? And so, I guess it's good that they snapped their 6 game losing streak. I mean, it's better than losing to UMass, right? If they lose to UMass, they probably do find $86 million buried somewhere. But none of it gave you any type of hope. Like you almost watched it, and I'm no A&M fan or whatever, but you almost watched it like through your fingers. Like it was that, like there was at one time, you know, Wigman tried to throw the ball and he never had the ball in his right hand. It didn't even fall out of his right hand. He didn't grab it out of his left hand to then throw it. Like it stayed in his left hand. He went to throw it and dropped it out of his left. Like, you know, it was just one of those games, you know, and it's just one of those seasons where it's over. It's done. You know, I'm worried about what they're going to look like next week against LSU. But yeah, I mean, the running game, not all that great. Passing game, not all that great. Defense, you know, I mean, it's UMass, you know, so whatever.
Right.
But, yeah, it's just a program that's struggling. It's a program that doesn't have a lot of belief. And more than that, it just feels like a program that doesn't look like it's having any fun at all. Like, nobody seems to be having any fun. The coaches, the fans, the players, the recruits, none of it. There's no buzz around A&M. And which is crazy because 8 months ago, all the buzz was around A&M. Jimbo Fisher's, you know, putting out diss tracks to Nick Saban. They're signing the best recruiting class of all time. You know, the fan base is just 100% like, look at us. We're, you know, we're sixth in the nation. We're a year away from competing for a chance, and it's all gone. You know, you go on Texags right now, and I mean, it might as well be January 6th there, you know, like they're going crazy over there. And so, it's an ugly scene, and I don't think it's going to get any better, even if they play well against LSU, which seems like an impossibility, because I'm not sure this locker room cares anymore about this season. It's a matter of who's going to enter the transfer portal and who's not at this point.
Yeah, basically, I agree. I think it just feels – I tweeted this last year, and I got a lot of flack because it was around coaching school last summer, and it was after – and it had a decent recruiting, a good recruiting class, not the one they had this past offseason. But I think it was during when Jimbo, it was 2021 during coaching school, during that panel. And he said, I don't think that the quote itself isn't relevant, but what I kind of said was, he said, the transfer portal isn't, I don't see the transfer portal as a route to sustain success or something like that. And sure, fine, you can make that argument or whatever. But my tweet was, I don't know if Jimbo Fisher should be talking about sustained success based on his resume, right? And A&M fans lost their, you know what, at me, saying, what do you mean? This is just a G5. Like, they brought up the fact that I was a Texas State student. You know, it was like, this is just jealousy, all this stuff. And I'm like, guys, the one job that he had is a crater at Florida State, right? Despite having recruiting classes and a national title and all this stuff. And I'm not saying I expected it to happen at A&M, but I'm saying he's not the one to be talking about that. And now, 12 months later, A&M is not looking like necessarily a crater, but it's getting there. It's burning to the ground a little bit, to where people are trying to figure out if there's close to $100 million in available money to move on from this. Because, like you said, no one looks like they're having fun. And there's not like – Connor Wigman is like the little kernel of optimism that you have, right? Yeah. And that's not looking great. I don't know. He looks good. I'm not saying that he looks fine, but like, he's not somebody that you're like, man, we got the guy, right? He's not that nailed on thing right now.
It's crazy though. When you do talk to A&M fans, like, that is the only kind of hope that they have is Connor Wigman. Like, you ask all of them and they all say the same exact thing. Because they're not talking about that recruiting class anymore.
No, well, look at this way. Your top recruit, David Hicks, has taken a visit to Norman, Oklahoma and Eugene, Oregon the past 2 weeks, right? He hasn't decommitted yet, but he's taking official visits still. That's not a good sign. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's
your other best commitment decommitted and probably going to commit to your rival that's joining the SEC in, after 2023. So
True. There's not a single program that – I can realistically say I have no idea what's going to happen in the next 6 months. Like, there's not another, like, I could speculate Texas State. I could speculate UNT, all these other programs with maybe uncertain coaching. I have no idea what A&M is going to look like in 6 months, roster wise, coaching wise, whatever. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, they're on the 24/7 talent composite. A&M is fourth. The top three teams have a combined 3 losses.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. It's not great. Not great. And by the way, I love how A&M's we're talking about this. After a win, they won. And we're just like, yeah, that was awful. Like, we're just like, this team is not. Yeah. Anyway, we'll have a whole offseason talk about this program. All right. Moving on. Oh, it's going to be something. UTSA 41, Rice 7.
I don't remember which game I was watching, but I was sitting there and I was like, oh, yeah, UTSA and Rice are playing. And I pulled it up, and it was the end of the third quarter, and it was 41-0. And I was like, oh, shoot. I was like, dang it, Rice.
That's just mean. Like, UTSA has nothing to play for. They're just like, no, we gotta rub some Rice's face in the dirt. Like,
they really did.
Frank Harris is like, yeah, I'm going to turn into a dual threat demon in this game and just, like, destroy this team. 3 touchdowns on the ground, 2 through the air. He didn't even have to stretch his. He didn't even have to like warm up his arm. He just threw like a couple hundred yards, or not even a couple, just like 100 yards almost exactly. And Rice had no shot. That was bad. We said Rice could only win this game one way, and it was close, and they probably couldn't pull it out. And UTSA is like, yeah, we're not going to worry about that. We're just going to come out the gates firing.
And Wiley Green got the start, and Wiley Green didn't finish the game. And that feels like a unfortunate common thread for Wiley Green. He just can't stay healthy, man. He just always gets banged up in games. Some of that's on the offensive line and just letting them take hits. But, you know, again, we're in another season where Rice is on their third string quarterback by the end of the year, you know, and, you know, they played four last year. They played three the year before. They played three the year before. I mean, it's been a common theme under Blomgren. And I don't know if it's unfortunate or if they're putting their quarterback at too much risk, you know, what it is there. But it's been something.
I believe they're on four for this year too, right? Total.
Yeah.
They may be. Yeah. I mean, they may be.
They put three quarterbacks in last night, and TJ McMahon was not one of them. So,
okay. Yeah. So,
McMahon's out, you know, with injury. Yeah. And so, it's just been a thing that's been a constant struggle for Rice during the Blomgren era. But, you know, as a UTSA grad, I tweeted that I lose so much money gambling on UTSA because I just, in my head, can't wrap it around how good UTSA is on just a week-in, week-out basis. Mm-hmm. You know, you're like, well, they've locked up Conference USA. You know, they play Rice and UTEP next week. Maybe they rest some guys. Maybe they're off. But, you know, Frank Harris takes like a second drive, runs 65 yards around the edge and just outruns everybody like he's still 18. But it's like three knee surgeries ago. You know, right. Frank's like just sprinting down the field. You know, he needs a statue. I was joking with Traylor, like, we need to retire his number, but he wears zero in that 210, you know, toughness thing. Like, I don't even know what we'd retire or whatever, but he's unquestionably the best player in program history. He's just a different dude, man. He's just really good. And, it's just, you know, now they clinched home field advantage. You know, it was pretty much locked up anyway. They would have had to lose their last two, but, you know, they clinched home field advantage for the second year in a row, Conference USA championship game. You know, next week literally has nothing to play for. So we'll see if he rests some guys there before a conference championship game against a North Texas team that had its bye this week, you know, so they're going to be a little bit rested. I would imagine they beat this Rice team pretty good next week there in Denton. I just think if it's UTSA, it's just kind of ho-hum, right? They're on a 7-game winning streak, 8-game winning streak, something like that, 7-0, 8-0 in conference. And this is just what they do. They go and they win conference games. Kind of like Gilmer back in the day with Jeff Traylor. They got into district play and they just won. And they get to conference play now and they just win. And they do it convincingly and they do it pretty easily. And so another impressive performance yesterday by UTSA, especially the defense, I thought. You know, to kind of stay engaged for that long, pitch a shutout for three quarters. They're playing their best football of the year. And it's amazing to think about because they kind of survived that first 3-game window where they were injured everywhere. You know, the offensive line's beat up, defenses beat up. Rashad Wisdom, their senior leader in the secondary, has been out for a couple weeks, and they've only gotten better, you know, and that's coaching, that's culture, that's next man up stuff. Every coach says it, but not every program believes it. UTSA is playing with a ton of belief right now, and they're rowing in the same direction. Like, TCU and UTSA are the only teams in this state with four or less losses, and some of that's talent. But a lot of that is just belief in the locker room. We talked about it with TCU earlier. They're down 8 with 5 minutes left to go. They miss a 2-point conversion. They never stop believing. They think they're going to go win that game. UTSA is kind of in the same mode where every single week they wake up and they think they're going to go dominate these teams, and they do. And so I think it's the hardest thing to do in college football is win games consistently when you're supposed to against talent you're better than. And UTSA doesn't lose those games, and that's a credit to Jeff Traylor and that staff.
Yep. 92-14 the past 2 weeks after wondering if this team was banged up, you know.
know nothing. So.
Yeah, exactly. We know absolutely nothing here. Next week is senior day. So I feel like, you know, we'll see, you know, depending on obviously what happens with Frank Ayers, if he decides to come back, but I presume we'll at least see them come out for a half, right? Really, you know, you mentioned resting the starters. I'm assuming Jeff Traylor will give those guys a good chunk of playing time, at least in the first half. Hopefully by the second half, they won't have to. But I know a lot of those guys who want to have their swan song out there for, especially for this season they put together. So moving on to Houston 42, ECU 3. I mean, Craven, is this the most impressive win of the Dana Holgorsen era? I wouldn't say it's the biggest because of the lack of stakes kind of overall, but is this the most impressive complete win? Because ECU, I mentioned it, a scary, complete, really talented program, and Houston just came out offense, defense, just silenced this, did not let them get in this game.
Yeah, it figures that Houston finally comes around as soon as I jump ship. You know, I've been holding on. Right. Like, as it's been sinking, I've been, like, holding on to, like, the top corner, you know, trying to, like, hold on to my Houston hype going before the year. And as soon as I take East Carolina in the points, they win by 39. So, welcome to college football. You know, this is the first time they've held an opponent under 20 points this year. I know that sounds crazy, but it's true, you know. Yeah. And so the defense finally came to play. You know, Clayton Tune's been playing pretty good since the bye week. You know, they've been putting up points. They've been scoring 30 or more pretty much every week for 2 months now. So the offense has been fine. It's been the defense has been so awful. They've turned the ball over a few times, like in that SMU game. But they avoided all that. You know, and they played a complete dominating game, offense, defense, special teams, four quarters. I think offensively what's really helped Houston is the emergence of Matthew Golden. We knew he was going to be good. He's a four-star guy that Holgorsen was pretty adamant that they wouldn't have landed if not for the Big 12 move. He, you know, he's from, I think, Klein Oak, somewhere around there. And so he was a local guy that they convinced to stay home. And he's provided an outside threat opposite of Nathaniel Dell that's really unlocked this offense, because now you can't just double and spy Nathaniel Dell with the safety over the top, because Matthew Golden will kill you. If you play a more honest defense, now all of a sudden Nathaniel Dell's one-on-one in the slot and he's going to beat that guy. Like, he's an NFL player. He's going to beat that dude. And so the offense has kind of become, you know, honestly better as the injuries have happened, as the running backs have just gone down and gone down, and they've gone, well, we're not going to be able to run the ball 30, 40 times a game. Let's put this on Clayton Tune. They've gotten better. The offensive line has gotten better. But I think the biggest difference yesterday was that's the third ward defense under Doug Belk we thought we were going to see for most of the year. I know they lost Logan Parr, Marcus Jones, you know, some guys, you know, after Logan Hall, I'm sorry, not Logan Parr. That's a offensive lineman at Texas, but they lost some starters from last year. You know, they had some injuries early in this year that lost some starters. And yesterday was the first time it looked like a good, solid, sound defense. We joked in the middle of the week how sometimes that secondary can be the Spider-Man meme, where a guy goes into the end zone and you got a safety pointing at a corner and a corner pointing at a safety. Like, whose guy is that? There was much better communication in the back end. The defensive line was really good. The linebackers were good. So, yeah, I mean, I would have to go back and look to see if there was another. I think dominant is probably the best way to put that. That was the most dominant win.
Complete.
The most complete win of Holgorsen's era. And so I think it's big for that locker room, because you risk losing them going into the Big 12. You risk kind of the sky is falling mentality happening around you. A 42-3 win over a pretty good East Carolina team can kind of quiet some of that, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Looking on Twitter, Joseph Duarte did tweet that in the press conference, Dana Holgorsen said, "This was a game I didn't know if I would see this season," you know, straight up. And he's, you know, we mentioned how very blunt of a head coach he is, right? So for him to say that, is pretty telling, right? He did not know if his team had this season. And I think it's a good, if you can end the year, I'm not saying with this kind of dominant win, you know, going out, but if you can win the year, if you can win out through the year and just kind of end on a positive note, right? It was such a lackluster, deflating year. There is some optimism and room for optimism heading into the Big 12. So I think this kind of win is like a nice little nugget to be like, look, there was some reason to be optimistic about this program heading into the year. Moving on, Texas 55, Kansas 14. Quinn Ewers did not have to even sweat, because Bijan Robinson
did all the work.
239, 24 carries, 4 touchdowns, career highs all around. Jonathan Brooks had over 100 yards on the ground. And look, I'm not saying we got to treat Quinn Ewers like, you know, Trent Dilfer, but when your running game is running, is working, you don't have to get cute. And Steve Sarkisian said, you know what? You're right. It's fine. We're just going to run the ball 30, 40 times. And by the end of the game, Kyle Flood was calling plays I saw, which I thought was interesting. I forgot who, Justin Wells, Joe Cook tweeted that he doesn't think it was like a personnel thing, as opposed to, hey, here, get some like play calling experience for Kyle Flood. So he doesn't think it was like Sark giving up the playbook or whatever, but it was like, we're in the lead, take the playbook, you know, well, you got this. But I thought that was interesting to add just another wrinkle and add another option of play calling potentially in the future. But regardless, keep it simple, man. Craven, you put in your 10 thoughts, keep it simple. And they came out with a damn good win over a team that I don't want to say was sneaky good. Kansas is just good this year, but they Jalen Daniels came out and started. Fans were excited, all that stuff. And Texas just put that to bed.
Yeah, I mean, the Kansas defense is really bad. You know, they rank in like the 100th and like essentially every single defensive category that you could care about. And so this was a game where if Bijan didn't touch the ball 20 plus times, like there's a crime against humanity. So, you know, sometimes you just got to keep it simple, you know, and so it's just keep it simple, Sark. Like last week, they ran the ball 22 times for 28 yards. You know, this week they ran the ball 57 times for 427 yards and six touchdowns. The Mr. Texas football is pretty good. John DeBrooks, pretty awesome. That, I don't know if y'all saw that touchdown run, but he ran through two dudes and it then exploded down the field. Like Rashawn Johnson, I think the bad news for Texas yesterday is Rashawn Johnson was in a walking boot by the end of the game. And that's one of their leaders and that's one of their best running backs. But when you have Jaden Blue and Jonathan Brooks just chilling over there
and then waiting for their turn. CJ Baxter, five-star coming in as a freshman next year.
running back room is going to be okay without Bijan and Rashawn, which is crazy to think about, you know, just how good that they've been able to run that out. But, you know, you just look at this box score, and I was able to listen to it on my way back, you know, listen to Craig Way on the way back from Waco driving to Austin. And, you know, you look at it and Ewers only has to throw 22 passes, and that's exactly the formula you want. And it feels like Sark finally figured that out. I hope it's not just because it was the way Kansas plays defense and he goes, we can game plan this. This is the best way to go about it. Like even against a good team, like even next week against Baylor, run the football. Even if it doesn't work the first time or the fifth time or the 12th time, keep doing it because the dam will break. Bijan will take over this game. He did it from the very beginning yesterday. He's a joy to watch. Texas fans, you only get two, maybe three more of these in the Bijan Robinson era. He went over 3,000 yards for his career, only the seventh running back ever for Texas to do that. And so, you know, for me, that was the biggest takeaway from yesterday is you don't get to just watch greatness all the time. And sometimes you just got to appreciate it. And 20 years ago, Bijan Robinson would be the number one pick in the NFL draft, right? Football's changed to where we don't appreciate running backs in the same way. But he's awesome, man. There's still nothing better to watch in football than a dominant running back. It's just fun to watch. Like, there's just something, I don't know, Neanderthal about it, right? Like, we want this to be a war game, and sometimes with the passing and stuff, it looks more like basketball. But when a dude just, like, has that kind of balance and speed and power, it's graceful. Like, it's like watching a ballerina on steroids, you know? Like, he's just awesome. And it's fun to watch. That defense has been really good. It's the best defense for Texas since 2009. And so they've been really good as a scoring defense. So impressive for Texas. But, you know, I'd ask you all this. Does a performance like that make you happy or more frustrated as a Texas fan? Because to me, as kind of a pseudo Texas fan who grew up around this program that just can't shake the burnt orange love, you know, as much as I try, it's those kind of performance yesterday's that makes me more frustrated.
It's like, you couldn't be doing this. Yeah. All right. Along.
It's like that. Look at all that talent.
Took you this long to figure it out. Yeah.
Like it's oozing. It's like oozing out of your pores and like, just go dominate teams. Just go beat teams. Right. Like, and Texas doesn't do it. And they do it every now and then. And you're like, there it is. Like that is what it should look like on a pretty, I know you can't beat teams like that every single week, but you should look that you're more talented. Just go step on dudes' throats. And they don't do that enough. So when they do it, it's like, man, why can't this happen 10 times a year like it used to?
Yeah.
I do wonder, to answer that question, I was thinking about this yesterday. And I just wonder, because we talked about the whole play designer versus play caller thing with Steve Sarkisian. And I think we attribute a lot of the Nick Saban, the Nick Saban coaches school for wayward kids or whatever we like to call it, Alabama. We like to attribute everything to like Lane Kiffin, right? It's like Lane Kiffin, he was one thing. He was not a good head coach, goes to Nick Saban. All of a sudden, FAU and Ole Miss are awesome, and he's probably going to get the Auburn job and all that stuff. I don't know if he changes necessarily your ability as a head coach that much. I think we're seeing it a little bit with Mike Locksley at Maryland, right? He was a bad head coach. Now he looks like a pretty okay head coach. Steve Sarkisian at Washington, and I know Washington wasn't exactly a glimmering program when he took over, but he was a 500 coach at Washington, right? At USC, obviously things ended the way they did there, but he was 3-2 that year before he had to leave.
I mean, they call him seven-win Sark out there.
Right. And so, like, I'm not saying he's going to win seven, you know, his ceiling is seven wins, but I do wonder if there is a little bit of a cap on what he, because again, USC was, it was not the USC that Lincoln Riley had to go rebuild, right? USC was supposed, was supposedly USC, right? It was, I think he was literally the next, was he right after Pete Carroll or did they have somebody else? Was it Lane Kiffin? I couldn't remember. But regardless, they were still like, they're coming off the Matt Barkley years and like, they were still very much USC in terms of recruiting. I just wonder, and again, he could absolutely prove me wrong next year if they live up to the hype, because the talent is absolutely, like you mentioned, just all there. But I can't shake the feeling that, like, do we just assume that these coaches, in particular him, not just to pick on him, but just like these Nick Saban coaches after the fact, are just going to blossom into Kirby Smart, right? And I don't know that, because, like, I agree with you. I'm frustrated watching that game yesterday, saying, like, where was that this whole time? And that's why I went back and looked at his Washington tenure and his USC tenure before he had to obviously step down. But it's just like, there's just a nagging thing with me where it's like his record versus winning teams, his record in close game, like it's consistent, right? Looking back at that USC year in 2015, they lost to both ranked teams that they played before he had to step down, right? Utah and I think it was Stanford. And so it's like, can you, is he a coach that can coach with or out coach his peers, not just play call, but just coach, right? Both sides of the ball, game plan. And so, yeah, I don't know. That's something to watch going forward, because I agree with you. This type of performance, this type of game should have been the standard. Not necessarily, like you mentioned, not necessarily winning like this, but like performing like this and seeing this. And we're basically basing this entire season off of a good loss against Bama, right? Yeah, so, by the way, Bijan Robinson sneakily has a chance, outside chance at 2,000 yards. He's at 1,400 right now. They play Baylor next weekend. They could make the Big 12 title game, and they have a bowl game. So he has three potential shots. I'm expecting him to go off in that bowl game if he plays. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he's going to play.
Right. If they make the Big 12 title game, if they win, this is all ifs, right? And he can make a New Year's Six and kind of have a nice little going out party, maybe. I don't know. That's the only shot. He's not playing the Alamo Bowl. Let's put it that way. Right. But if they make a New Year's Six and he can have like a nice little showing, right? He has an outside shot, right? It's still a long shot, 600 yards away. But I don't know. We'll see. It's been a quietly great year for him, to me.
If I'm a Texas fan, I'm moving with the assumption that next week against Baylor is the last time Bijan Robinson puts on burnt orange. You know, unless Kansas State loses and they make the Big 12 title game, like you say, he's not going to play in the Alamo Bowl, and he shouldn't.
Yeah. No, I was about to say, no, absolutely not. Yeah.
And so,
if they make a New Year's Six, he should play if he wants to play. Yes. Right? Like he's somebody who may want to play, because obviously he probably wants that chance to play in a big high stakes bowl game, but
right.
He shouldn't. Yeah. You shouldn't expect him to play if they make it, just because for all the talk about, man, they're not using Bijan enough. He's still sitting at 1400 yards on the ground. He's awesome. So good. So good. All right. Last one, Texas State 16, Arkansas State 13, Seth Keller. Two more. Sorry. Oops. Let's talk about this one anyway.
Don't skip my UTEP minors.
Well, we'll save them for last now.
Okay.
Texas State 16.
Ish was just so excited to talk about Texas State.
I'm really not.
16-13, baby. Let's go.
Seth Keller, game winner. I don't know. Good job. That's all I got, man.
I thought it was a pretty impressive win, you know? Like, the defense continues to be dominant. You know, that defense has been the best scoring defense in the G5 ranks in the state this year. Like they've been a 7-8 win defense, you know, like the defense deserves better than what's going on right now. But what I thought was impressive about yesterday is, you know, the weather's bad. The focus is on the 40-year anniversary of the 82 national championship team. The crowd's not huge for obvious reasons. You know, one's weather, one's seven losses. It would have been very easy for that coaching staff and those players to kind of fold up. And they didn't. They went out and played a good game. Arkansas State comes and ties it at 13, you know, with only a minute and a half, 2 minutes left to go. And Texas State's offense immediately goes right down the field, gets into field goal position and makes the game winner. And so I think, you know, we talk about this sometimes on the show where, you know, college football can be looked at in the prism of you're either really good or you stink. And, you know, Texas State, like, it's not all wins and losses, you know, like some of this is about, like, you know, growing up young people and, you know, to deal with that kind of adversity. I mean, because everybody in the world's been talking about how, you know, Jake Spavadal is not going to be there next year. You know, it's on, you know, every podcast, ours, we're writing about it. We're talking about it because everybody's whispering about it. And like that gets into locker rooms. Like the players aren't immune to that stuff. They hear that stuff. They know they have family, they have friends that are asking about that. And, you know, it can get really easy to just quit, you know, and to not care. And it seemed like a team and a group that still cared and still was playing for their coaches and playing for their school and playing for the name on the back and on the front. And so, you know, I think that's commendable. I think that's something that we should, you know, praise because it doesn't happen everywhere. And this generation gets knocked for not being tough and not dealing with adversity and full. And that's not what happened yesterday. And so, you know, good on Texas State, good on that coaching staff for keeping everybody together and to keep playing hard. You know, Jake's better, you know, one of them had, I think you sent me a tweet, you know, where one of them kind of mentioned that, you know, where it's like the outside noise can get really heavy. And you know, I'm proud of these guys for going out there and playing really hard. And I think that's a positive deal. Even if Spav's not there next year, there's going to be a lot of guys that are, you know, and whoever that new coach is knows he's going to inherit a locker room with dudes that will go out there and keep fighting. And that's a good thing for this program.
Yeah, I was going to say that the cryptic tweet you're mentioning was from Zach Spavadal, the defensive coordinator, who I'll just read a little bit of it because it was a very blatant subtweet. So this is from it was a little notes app drop on Twitter. After the game, he said, "I don't have much time to tweet or soul search during the season, but I need to shout out our players tonight. Extremely proud to coach them and can't thank them enough for the work they have done. Sometimes in life, outside noise can be very loud. They haven't listened and continue to play for the right reasons. Best defense at this level the school has seen." One, not wrong, right? It's been very good. But that certain phrase, right? Soul search. Of course, we talked about President Kelly Dampus tweeting a couple weeks ago, where this week is time for soul searching. You know, there is some animosity there. I do know for a fact that a lot of players and coaches were not happy with that tweet that he sent out. I can very much confirm that. So that subtweet more or less confirms that as well. So they're playing for each other. Like you mentioned, they are kind of like insulating themselves and say, let's just blinders on, get to this end of the season. We'll see what happens at this point. So commending, definitely commendable for them. All right, let's get to the actual last game. UTEP 40, FIU 6. We were pretty sneakily worried about this game because FIU, of course, still has a lot to play for. They could make a bowl game in Mike McIntyre's first year. UTEP still desperately clinging to bowl hopes as well. They needed this game. They need to win out, and they got a dominant effort in FIU. They basically just shut down a young FIU team where at the beginning of the year, you would have said UTEP should be able to beat a team like this, exactly like this. And that is exactly what happened. Calvin Brownholtz got the start. He was fine. They just controlled the game. They just shut them down defensively. This was a little bit of the UTEP defense we expected to see, where they're just absolutely sitting on a game, forcing a couple turnovers. Grayson James never looked comfortable. Good job. Like now you set up a huge game and a huge, you know, against the UTSA team, which, again, we'll see how they come out, but theoretically has, quote-unquote, nothing to play for next week, and you have a lot to play for your UTEP.
I think this UTEP offense looks better with Calvin Brownholtz leading it, you know?
They certainly, like, they're because he's a dual threat and they can call, I think it's definitely more creative, right? With Gavin Hardison, you kind of, I mean, we mentioned it, you know what it is, right? It's a downfield vertical play action pass, you know, things like kind of like that explosive offense in one way. Calvin Brownholtz, yeah, it's balanced. They can have a running threat more consistently instead of just pounding Ronald Awatt or Deion Hankins into 8-man boxes every time.
I think he's better at the short and intermediate throws as well, at least more consistent, you know, doesn't have the vertical big arm, you know, that Hardison does, but I think he's just a more controlled passer, and he gives them a power running game that Hardison doesn't. You look, I mean, we talked about it all year, right? Just like run the rock. And then you look at this thing and it's, you know, they throw 18 passes. They run the ball 61 times. They had three running backs with at least 13 carries, you know. Flores had 13 for 128. Awatt, 17 for 84. Hankins, 14 for 81. Like, that's it. That's the recipe. Run the ball, play good defense. They did both of those things. Coming off of a bye at home, you would imagine that's the performance that you get. Good on them. And you know, now, I mean, on paper, they're definitely the underdog at UTSA. Mm-hmm. But there's something you can follow here, because last year, UTSA was in this exact same position mm-hmm. against a 5-6 team the week before a conference championship game, and they got blown out by North Texas.
A team playing for their coach's job, potentially.
Playing for a coach's job and playing the type of way that you run the ball 61 times.
Right.
And so UTEP, I think they can pull from that. You know, like, hey, UTSA doesn't have anything to play for. They're wanting to get out of this game. Let's give them a reason. Let's get up 14, 17, now. Let's punch them in the mouth and see if they're willing to exchange fire there. And so I think if you're UTEP, you got plenty to play for. That's the type of performance that will make everybody believe. And now you go and you basically play in a playoff game, you know, against maybe the future conference champion. You can do a lot of stuff here. So that's a big win for UTEP, because if you lose that game, you know, now you got nothing to play for next week. Now the fan base is on you for losing to FIU. Your locker room gets a little sketchy, but you go and you dominate. Now you still got everything to play for, and it basically becomes a bowl game in San Antonio for the Miners. And if they can go pull that upset, you know, they're back-to-back bowl games for only the second time this century, only the third time as a football program. Like, we got to remember who we're talking about here. This is UTEP. Yeah. You know, getting to five wins is a good thing for UTEP. We're 3 or 4 seasons away from winless, one win, one win. You know, and so, you know, these are the good times. This is a good thing that's happening for UTEP. To play an important game after Thanksgiving is not a given for the UTEP Miners. And for most mm-hmm. of my lifetime, it has not been the case. And so for Dana Dimel, back-to-back, to be playing important, meaningful games at this time of year is a sign to me that UTEP football is moving in a competent direction. And when Conference USA gets a little bit more easy, as these teams kind of cycle out, you know, UTEP looks like a program that could get to 6, 7, 8 wins on a year-in, year-out basis and eventually compete for maybe conference championships.
Yep, I was going to say, the first step with UTEP is stop. It's basically like, it's not the same exact thing, but it's basically like Kansas, right? The first step is stop being a doormat, right? That's the very first step when you take over UTEP, is you cannot be an automatic win. Dana Dimel is past that point now. Now it's like, okay, now can we be a team that people consistently hate playing against? They're getting to that point. And if they can take that next step, like you mentioned, back-to-back bowl games, okay, now that is definitely a trajectory and there's definitely tangible improvement over your tenure to be like, look, now we're getting to a spot where they're stable. We're entering a new conference or new conference look, environment, I should say. And we can be a player in this conference going forward. So I agree. Next week is a huge moment to play for. And like you said, we've seen UTSA stumble a little bit when they kind of have things locked up and things kind of ready to play for down the line and looking ahead a little bit. So, all right, that'll do it for us. So yeah, a lot of blowouts, but most of them good. So that's a good thing. And of course, A&M played a game. So there's that. That'll do it.
Guys, before we go.
Yes.
We only have one more of these to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we'll do our bowl preview as well. Our bowl prediction show.
Yeah, I just mean, like, we only got one more week of college football, like a full slate of regular season college football games.
The marathon's almost over.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, like,
it's gone as quick as it came.
I know.
Early in the year, I'm anticipating everything. I'm super excited. Middle of the year, I'm overwhelmed and tired and just want it all to go away so I can go to sleep. And then this time of year, it's like, oh, man. It's almost gone. It's going to be gone for a whole year.
And then, like, we're still talking about teams where we're like, I don't know what they are yet.
Dana Holgorsen didn't even know he could get this type of performance, you know, and he's around him every day, you know? And so it's been a weird year in the state, honestly. It's just a bunch of average teams, two really good teams, and then a bunch of average teams, and then no really bad team.
No.
Mm-hmm. Like, I was gonna say, like, Texas at least State, UTEP's as bad as it gets, and they're,
I was about to say, and the defense is good for Texas State, at least, like, they're little kernels of quality all the way around, so.
I think we were also optimistic about every single team at least having a chance to get to 6 wins to make a bowl game, too. There wasn't a team that we were, like, beginning of the season, absolutely not going to get to a bowl game, you know?
And, right. That's a good point. Next week, 11 of the 12 are still alive or already qualified for bowl games. And so it's been a weird year in the state, like a good year, but not a great year. Like it's been different. It's been a different type of season.
Definitely. So we'll be back for our last Sunday recap next week. But of course we'll have our Tuesday. Oh, actually, I don't know. Are we doing it on Wednesday? Because Thanksgiving. We'll decide that.
We'll have to figure that out.
We'll figure that out. Regardless, we'll be back next Sunday for our last recap episode. With that being said, we've interviewed 12 of the eventual 13 FBS head coaches. Jimbo Fisher, you have no fans to mingle with, so give us a call back, at least based off that game in Kyle Field. Well, I don't know. According to them, they had 90,000 people there for him to talk to, so we'll see.
talk to him. He just may not like the conversation.
Yeah.
I was about to say. Everybody will talk to him then. As usual, even though they lost 55-10, Penn State, go Rutgers.